bring high school students from Port Washington High School. Would they stand, please? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. These students are here with us this morning with a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Supreme Court. The program is entitled Court with Class. High school students from around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument, and if the school accepts the invitation, the students are sent briefs, the case they will hear. And they may do some activities around this case in their classroom. They then come and hear the oral argument, and at noon they meet with a justice of the court who will discuss with the students the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the case they are about to hear. Now, I see there are other students and others in the courtroom this morning. We have summaries of the case you are about to hear outside, and if you do not have a summary, please raise your hand and the marshal will give you one. It's easier to understand an oral argument if you have some basic information about the case. Everyone is invited after this case to join the students in hearing a discussion of the court's procedures. Let me introduce the court to you all. I'll start on my far right with Justice Patience Rubensack. She is the justice with whom you will meet right after this case. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To Justice Bradley's left is Justice David Prosser, and to his left is Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I will now turn to our second case this morning, and that is 03-2164, Julie Ann Wahlberg versus St. Francis Home, Inc., et al. I have the arguments first by Kenneth A. Knutson, representing St. Francis Home, and then 15 minutes for Attorney Gleisner, and then 15 minutes for David White, who may appear pro hoc vici. Is Mr. White or Wheat here? And Mr. Gleisner?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, we'll start with you, Mr. Knutson.
Thank you, Your Honor. And please, the court. As you know, I thought I would be here in 13 days, hopefully with the spirit of my trial team. I appreciate the court having made me so comfortable today in inviting students, because that's how I've been here 13 times over the last 20-some years, usually in the audience, watching my students perform in mock trial. I hope that I make as good a presentation as some of my students have over the year, but I do thank you for making me comfortable. Secondly, you know, as I listened to the first oral argument and thought about this case, I can truly say, if I had ever dreamt that this case would come to the Supreme Court and I'd be making oral argument, I probably wouldn't have made a motion to dismiss. I'd avoided and got the rest of the facts and had them here for you today and made a motion for summary judgment, because so much isn't in front of you that's relevant in this case. One of the things I noted from the Court of Appeals decision was the fact that they assume, and we have to for purposes of motion for summary judgment, that the action accrued on December 3rd of 1996. And, of course, we don't know when the tort action accrued. Some of those facts aren't before you. We do know that Lucille Yachts had Alzheimer's. We do know that she was in St. Francis South for a period of a couple of years, which ended on December 3rd, 1996. We know she died of unrelated natural causes about 4 years later, and that this suit was filed about 2 years after that. But I want to say that in the facts that deal with this case, in many ways, I've been going over and over in my mind how to make a cogent summarization of what the real issue before the court is today. And I am somewhat humbled, because when I got here and read the synopsis you sent out, I think you've got the point of what all these briefs should have said very clearly, done very well. And here's what I think the trial court was trying to say, and what I think the Court of Appeals mistakenly did. I believe that this synopsis is correct, that while a person is alive, that 893.16 applies. And when I read the amicus curiae brief and thought about the issues that they raised and the fact that one of the obligations that I've taken very seriously since I was sworn in this room in 1976 was that we need to protect those that are the weakest. And 893.16 does that while they're alive, and properly so. I think the difference is that 893.22 deals with the situation for their heirs or for the estate. And that's the difference in this case. 893.16 is a statute for living. 893.22 deals with the situation that arises when a disabled person dies. And I think that's what the trial court tried to do in making their assessment, is that the heirs of such a person, if you read this the way the Court of Appeals has set it forth, are treated differently than the heirs of anybody else. And that doesn't appear to be a proper and fair way to make these two statutes work. I mean, let's face it. Mrs. Yox, who is the one person being protected by 893.16, is dead. Yeah? Her husband predeceased her. The fact is that the statute was extended during her life. And upon her death, her heirs, who are not disabled, I mean, that's not an issue in this case, should be treated like the heirs of anybody else. And frankly, to use the assessment that the Court of Appeals gave, I believe creates the chance for just unbelievable ramifications that I think will cause more litigation and more confusion and more difficulty through the years. And part of why I feel that is, while I firmly believe that we need to protect the weakest in society, and I think that that's what 893.16 does, that we also have to realize, as we referred to in our reply brief, the fact that defendants need to be protected too, and that the longer the time is between the circumstances which gave rise to the cause of action and when the action is already brought, that delay also affects justice. I can assure the court that when a person, whether it's a company or the individuals who would be the witnesses in this case, are involved, these kinds of allegations are very serious. And to try to defend yourself 6 years after these events took place is extremely difficult.
Counselor, are you saying that if Sam Smith had a cause of action for getting hit by a car, and that cause of action arose 6 months before his death, that if he died, his heirs would have to bring that claim within 1 year of his death?
No, I'm not. In fact, I don't believe that's what 893.22 does. What 893.22 does is it says that if you die, you get one more year to bring your cause of action, so that it would extend it for Sam Smith. If he died in the first year after the accident, no more time. In the second year after the accident, no more time. But in the third year after the accident, one additional year, or the primary statute of limitations, whichever is more. And in that regard, I have to concede that I believe the trial court made an error as to the contract claim in this case. And when I look at
it. Before us, is it?
Pardon me?
Is that one before us?
Not really. You know, part of the problem with that is the contract claim is really about a remedy where they're claiming reimbursement of what was paid based on the same theories, I believe, as the tort action that there was some breach of duty. But in a contract claim, if you read 893.22 correctly, what would have occurred is that upon her death, Mrs. Ziox would have had 1 year under 893.22 or the original contract statute of limitations, which would be 6 years from the last date, so that what would be available to the plaintiff on contract would essentially run from April 12, 1996 to December 3, 1996. If you take the appeals court decision on its face, what it means is that anyone who is disabled, their heirs, have 8 years to bring a tort action and 11 years to bring a contract action. I think that's what the Court of Appeals says. They basically said death is not an issue here. And as the case scenario that you spelled out, I think that's exactly the issue here. You know, when you look at the language of 893.16, it doesn't mention death. In fact, there's a real unusual thing in the statute. When you look at it, it talks about the period of extension not being more than 5 years. That's interesting. Why would you say more than? Why not just say 5 years? Because that, I submit, is what the Court of Appeals said. I think they just said, if you're disabled, that disability is not going to go away. You've got 8 years. And they stretched it to say your heirs have 8 years if you die during that period of time. And I don't believe that's there. 893 does not mention the word death. But 16 doesn't mention the word death. 893.22 does. And it's a logical assumption that the heirs or the estate have 1 year or the original statute of limitations, whichever is more. And when you look at 893.16, where it talks about or more, or never more than the 5 years, I think that's because it contemplates loss in two situations. One is that the person recovers from mental illness. Then they get 2 years from the date of recovery. And if that's less than the 8 years in a tort, that's what they would get. Or two, they die. Then I think that the terms of 893.22 apply, and they get 1 year unless the original statute hasn't run, then they get that, because that's what 893.22 says.
Mr. Gleisner, I think, argues that the estate is really assuming all the rights of the deceased and is in the same position as the deceased. How do you attack that argument?
I don't think it's correct. I basically feel that 893.22 does not give the estate or the heirs the same rights as the deceased under that situation, because I think, like the trial court did, Judge Vonnegut did in his decision, that you don't read these statutes to create a conflict, but you read them in harmony. That 893.16 applies while the person is alive, and 893.22 applies upon that person's death as to how the estate and heirs will be treated. Who are we trying to protect under 893.16? I guess that's how I reply. Under 893.16, I think we're trying to protect the person who is disabled and the living. I don't think it mentions death because it doesn't contemplate protecting their non-disabled heirs or the estate. I think that's what 893.22 does. So that's my response. Now, I think that the case law that the trial court referred to and that we've referred to is that it's important to harmonize these. Let me give you an example of why I think that there could be some absurd findings on that. It goes back to a little bit of the example that Justice Robinsack made. Let's take two people that fall down or are in high school on the same day, and they're both injured. And they both die 2.5 years later from unrelated causes. One of those persons is mentally ill. High school students, maybe they have schizophrenia that affects their ability to think. Under the Court of Appeals decision, the heirs of that high school student would have 8 years to bring a tort action, so that they, those parents, would essentially have an additional 5.5 years, and the student, the parents, or the heirs of the other student would have 1 more year. I don't think that makes sense. And that's what the trial court said, is why would you treat the heirs of a person who are not disabled so totally different than the heirs of a person who is not?
Knudsen, if I could, your opposing counsel in pages 14 through, I think, 19 of its brief points out the applicable case law, cites Curran v. Witter, Palmer v. O'Rourke, and Mr. Gleisner's brief adds Wisconsin Trust v. Cousins to argue for the proposition that 893.22 only reaches a case where the person entitled to bring the action dies during the last year of the term of limitation. Now, my understanding is that in interpreting a statute, this Court's pronouncements interpreting that statute over time become part of the statute, if not later reversed by the legislature. So how do you get around what the Court has said since 1887?
Well, one thing I would say, Your Honor, is the last sentence of 893.16 says that it does not apply to any action that accrued before 1970. So that clearly the legislature added that, I believe, to in fact take that issue out of it, that they were looking at something different when they passed that, and that's why where 893.17 talks about death, 893.16 does not, and 893.22 does. So I believe that the legislature, when they redrafted that law and put in that it didn't apply to anything that accrued before a certain date, basically dealt with that issue because they contemplated the entirety of the legislation, that they were protecting, as they state, those who are most needing it, the person who is disabled while they're alive. But why would we give additional time to their non-disabled heirs? I don't think it makes sense. And neither did the trial court. You know, and I think the difficulty is when you have such a long gap, you of course create a problem that the courts have historically recognized in trying to defend these cases, people's memories, the facts. You know, the fact that St. Francis no longer exists. You know, those kind of things are a real issue. I think that you need to make that break. You know, frankly, if you don't, then we're going to have 8-year statute of limitations for any disabled person, no matter when they die, under the Court of Appeals decision, and 11 years on a contract. And I think those are going to be difficult cases for both the plaintiff, though I'm sure the plaintiff would say that's our problem, but also for the defendants to try to remember what occurred. And it makes sense and logic to apply it the way the trial court did and the way I suggest today. Protect the disabled while they're alive. When they die, give their heirs of the estate 1 year as provided for 893.22, or the primary statute of limitations, which that statute contemplates.
So what do you do in a situation such as this, where the person representing the estate isn't even appointed until 2 years later?
Well, that's not the case. This is the daughter of Mrs. Yock. There's an affidavit in the trial court that she was appointed as the daughter of Mrs. Yock the day they filed suit. It's not an unrelated person.
But that was after, that was, as I understood the facts, and correct me if I'm wrong, that was 2 years after the death.
That's correct. At the time of her death, her sister was the guardian of the estate, and Mr. Yox was the guardian of his wife's person and estate until he died in 1999, which was already 3 years after.
But the point is that the personal representative might not get appointed even within that 1 year after death. So who can sue?
Either the heirs or the personal representative they would get appointed. And I think that would be true for anybody.
Where do you get the conclusion that the personal heir, the heirs can sue even if no representative of the estate is appointed?
You're correct, Your Honor. The personal or the heirs would have to file an estate, such as done in this case, and get appointed as the special administrator, such as done in this case. They're an interested party and they bring it.
And if they fail to do that, then they've just missed the statute of limitations under your argument.
If anybody fails to do it under 822 within 1 year, and the statute of limitations, the underlying one, has run, so that 1 year extension has run, then all of them would be barred, and those cases would be too old to bring. What the difference here is we're trying to treat the heirs of a disabled person differently than everybody else. And I don't submit that that's what the law was stretched to say. If 893.16 was dealing with that situation, it should have said so. It should have said death was the still allowed an extra 2 years. Why even then have 893.22? We're trying to protect the disabled person by 893.16, not their non-disabled heirs or estates or special administrators. I don't see anything under that that provides for additional time for them, and I don't understand why those persons who are not disabled or are appointed by the court should get at minimum twice the amount of time if you take the plaintiff's original argument before the court, or 8 years if you take the way the Court of Appeals wrote that decision. I mean, that when I read the Court of Appeals decision, it's saying that death is not an issue, that you get a flat-out 8 years from the time of the incident if you're disabled. And they really don't talk about the special administrator or the heirs either. I guess when I use heirs, I use them as people who would file for an estate. And I think that's what's so important in harmonizing these two statutes. Judge Gronick was right. There is no conflict here. It makes perfect sense, and maybe I'm repeating myself, but it makes perfect sense to me to protect that disabled person while they're alive, but I do not see at that point why they need twice or two or three times as long as everybody else does in that situation. And that it makes sense to harmonize the statutes under that scenario.
Counsel, I'm focusing on 893.22 and the language that gives me problems has existed for a long time. And the language is at the end of the first sentence of 893.22, which is, after the expiration of that time and within 1 year from the person's death. It's that language. So I want to focus on that language, and I want you, if you would, to assist me in walking me through what that language means. And I'm going to, if I may, read it. If a person entitled to bring an action dies before the expiration of the time limited for the commencement of the action. Okay, let's say we had, as in this case, a disabled person. Let's say it was a three-year, it was personal injury, three-year statute of limitations. And under 893.16, there would be an additional 5 years, assuming she's living. Is that correct?
Not more than 5 years.
Not more than 5 years.
Eventually, it would be less.
If the disability ceases, but
or death.
Or, yeah, okay. But so she would have, let's say, 5 years. So 3 plus 5 is what she has. But let's say she dies in year 4. Okay? She dies in year 4. So what does this phrase mean, that the person's representative can bring the cause of action after the expiration of that time? Now, that is the 3 plus 5. She has a 3-year cause of action, plus she has an additional 5 years under sub 16 because she is disabled. So we could bring it under my hypothetical. After the expiration of that time, which is 8 years, and within 1 year from the person's death. I say that's an impossibility.
It may well be. It may well be. I mean, the trial court looked at that and said, that you got 1 year from the time of death in order to bring your action, both actions, and dismissed on that basis. And that's exactly the issue that was reversed, because I believe, and I believe the trial court believed, that the language when in 893.22 that refers to as the time for that cause of action is the time established for the various causes of action, which would be 3 years for torts, 6 years for contract, or different years for real estate matters. That's what I think that refers to. The trial court read it like you just pointed out and said, and you get 1 year from the time of death. I mean, let's remember there was a period of time where a tort action didn't survive. Now, the law changed on that. I mean, the state of Wisconsin has always recognized that death is a change in the status, and it should. I mean, the defendants are denied the right to cross-examine the person, the right to cross-examine their spouse. After a certain amount of time, the right to cross-examine anyone with current memory of what occurred. And if you read it the way the Court of Appeals does, well, we'd be trying to determine a tort action up to 8 years later. That's an impossible burden. I think you'd be flooded with cases where you're trying to figure out whether or not it's pure speculation as to what occurred.
Well, isn't your read of sub 16 put you in a position of trying to determine a tort action 8 years later?
You could, but at least the person's still alive, because I think it only applies during life. I think once they die, they get 1 year. And that's how I harmonize the two. And it still is going to cause a problem, but at least I'm closer in time to when the person died. I mean, this case is 2 years, less 3 days, after she died, that they suddenly decided to file for a special administration final claim. They were done the same day. You know, what about the case, if you take the Court of Appeals and what you just hypothesized, where the person dies in the third year, right after the statute would have run the primary, they're disabled, and they die 2 months later? I believe harmonizing these should give them additional year. But the Court of Appeals gives them 8. They could sit around for 4.5 more years before filing their action. And I think that puts us in a horrendously difficult position and treats them so much differently than all the rest of the population.
Suppose a cause of action has 1 year to run. Person is not disabled. Person dies. Okay? How long does the personal representative have to bring the cause of action?
My reading of it is, and in fairness, that's what I think is appropriate, is they would have either the 3 years or 1 year from the date of death.
Either one? Or just 1 year after death?
Within 1 year after death, for that much extent. So the person died after 2 years and 8 months. The regular statute would run 4 more months. I think they'd have 1 year.
Suppose the person dies after 1 year of running the statute. So they would have, if they lived, to have 2 more years, right? How long does the personal representative have to bring the cause of action?
I believe they would have the 3 years.
How do
because
they
have? I think that when it refers to this, it's to the 3-year period of the original tort action.
That's after that time.
That's right. And that would also fit with the wrongful death statute. If a person is actually killed in the accident, the law gives them 3 years. So I think there's some consistency there that follows. I mean, if you think about the wrongful death action, what if the disabled person, like in this case, actually was killed because of the negligent act? They slip you up their head and they die. Under the wrongful death action, they'd have 3 years. Under the tort, they'd have 3 years. Under the reading of the Court of Appeals, they'd have 8. You'd have a conflict now with the wrongful death statute. And that's why I don't think you can read it that way. That's why 893.16 doesn't mention the word death. I'm out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Knutson. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel?
Thank you, Chief Justice, honorable members of the court. May it please the court, I'm Attorney Bill Gleisner, and I'm appearing on behalf of the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers. Chief Justice, I believe I have...
Amicus. You represent the amicus.
Yes, Justice, I do. I represent the amicus curiae, yes. I believe we have a little housekeeping work that has to be done.
All right.
I understand that Mr.
I'm accustomed to that.
Pardon me. Yes, Justice. Mr. White was admitted pursuant to an order that arrived yesterday, pro hoc vice, but the Wisconsin attorney who moved his admission will not be able to be here today, and I understand that Mr. White has to be introduced by a member of the bar, so as active member of the bar, I'm formally introducing Mr. White to the court as counsel for plaintiff appellant.
And he is a member in good standing?
Yes, Justice, he is a member. He is.
Okay. He will be admitted for purposes of the argument today.
Thank you, Justice. We wish to thank Mr. White for graciously agreeing to share some of his time with us today. And we also thank this court very much for the privilege of appearing as amicus curiae. The Academy has asked for the opportunity to address this court, of course, because the purpose or the proper interpretation of statutes of limitation and tolling statutes is of great importance to all court victims. Just as significantly, however, we are addressing this court today because we believe that this case involves the most vulnerable citizens in our society, namely individuals who reside in a nursing home and suffer from serious mental disabilities such as Alzheimer's disease. We will address the arguments of the petitioner as to both 893.16 and .22, but we would like to begin this morning with 893.22. We respectfully, very respectfully, submit that the fundamental error in the petitioner's reasoning is that they claim, they believe, that 893.22 is a statute of limitations. We respectfully submit that it is not. It is exactly the opposite. It's a saving statute designed long ago by our legislature to expand otherwise applicable statutes of limitation so as to permit personal representatives an opportunity and a reasonable amount of time, extra time, to open an estate, marshal assets, assess claims, and assert claims that survive death. This is what the Michigan Supreme Court did. This is how it construed a very similar statute 3 years ago. And this is how this court construed a predecessor of 893.22 in Wisconsin Trust Company versus Cousins. In Wisconsin Trust, a trust company, which was acting as an investment agent of a one Mr. Williams, allegedly made a negligent investment on May 1, 1905. The court noted that the statute of limitations applicable to this cause of action would run as of May 1, 1911. Unfortunately for Mr. Williams, he died on April 7, 1911, with 23 days left to run on that statute of limitations. This court in 1920, citing the very same language, basically, that is contained in the first section of 893.22, concluded that that language, quote, became applicable to this situation and continued the right existing at the time of Mr. Williams' death to bring such action to his representatives up to and until April 7, 1912, close quote. In other words, the remaining 23 days of Mr. Williams' negligence claim and the statute of limitations applicable to that claim survived his death, and then the predecessor to 893.22 saved to the decedent's estate, saved the decedent's estate from losing the ability to pursue the survival action for one additional year from and after April 7, 1911 to April 7, 1912. I think, Justices, before proceeding further, it would be good to discuss basically what the courts in this state have thought about survival actions and what they have written about survival actions. In this regard, the petitioners seek to minimize the 1999 decision in the state of Merrill versus Jarrett by trying to distinguish it away in a footnote. But this case is very important because in this case, the Court of Appeals really demonstrated what the courts in this state think of survival actions. In that case, a decedent sustained personal injuries on November 23, 1994, and died 3 days later from his injuries on November 26, 1994. He was comatose between the date of his injury and the date of his death. And There was no wrongful death action involved in Merrill whatsoever. However, the decedent's personal representative commenced a survival action for personal injuries 3 years later on November 26, 1997, or 2 years beyond what the petitioners, I think, contend is the limit in 893.22. In addition to that, the Court of Appeals in Merrill, in allowing this state's survival action, did so on a theory that the decedent, such as Merrill, could not have discovered his cause of action before death, and so that cause of action could not have accrued within the meaning of well-known cases such as Hansen versus A.H. Robbins. The Court of Appeals then specifically stated, and I quote, because Merrill would have had the benefit of the discovery rule if he had lived, and brought the tort action in his own name if he had lived, it is not fair to reach a contrary result due to his death. We conclude that the fact the victim is deceased does not preclude the application of the discovery rule to the survival action. Close quote. Justice, we respectfully submit that there are a number of other reasons to conclude that 893.22 is a saving statute and not a statute of limitations. This Court can take judicial notice of the fact that sections 893.10 through 893.23 inclusive are included in a section of the current statutes annotated under a heading entitled, quote, limitations total or extended, close quote. Also, again, at a very basic level, 893.22 states that if an action survives, an action may be commenced, and in contrast, many of the statutes of limitation in 893.20, chapter 893, specify that an action shall be commenced within a specified period of time. If my time permits, I will elaborate on several points regarding evidence of the legislative intent underlying 893.22. Otherwise, we will rest on the arguments in our amicus brief in that regard. I would like to turn now to, or briefly, to the petitioner's argument that 893.16 only applies to living persons. In addition to the arguments that we make in our amicus brief, we would also respectfully submit that a concession made by the petitioners in their Court of Appeals brief significantly undercuts their position in this Court. At pages 2 to 3 of that Court of Appeals brief, after conceding that the underlying statute of limitations were told in this case because of Yox's disability, at least during her lifetime, the petitioners state, quote, under 893.16, and ignoring 893.22. If Yox's death was a cessation of disability, then her representatives would have had until August 15, 2002, to commence an action. Close quote. The plaintiff appellant, in fact, commenced an action in this case on August 12, 2002. Candidly, we can't conceive of how one argues that death doesn't end a disability. Therefore, we respectfully submit that if 893.22 does not limit the plaintiff appellant's claim, the concession that I just recited eliminates any basis for dismissing the complaint in this action. However, we agree with the Court of Appeals that if one accepts the suggestion of the petitioners that the disability of Yox didn't end with death, then the five-year outside limit in 893.16 would apply, and the statute of limitations applicable to the court action, which accrued on December 3, 1996, would not have run, we maintain, until December 3, 2004. I see that I do have time remaining, and so I will return to the issue of what evidence exists as to the legislative intent, or the legislature's intent, when it enacted the predecessors to 893.22 back in 1849. Perhaps because it was first drafted.
Could I ask you a question?
Yes, Justice.
Is there any authority that you can cite, that the trial judge made this point? Is there any authority that you can cite that death ceases disability? Or you rely simply on logic or something?
Well, I rely on the authority cited by the plaintiff appellant in his brief. He cited a number of cases from out of state that death ends a disability. I believe that was your question, Justice. Logic does play a part in it, But even if death doesn't end a disability, then there's a 5-year, in effect, statute of repose, similar to what's in the Med-Mal statute, that says that there's an outside limit on how long a statute, how long a disability will continue if a person doesn't recover from it. That outside limit would have taken us to December 3rd, 2004. So we would submit that either way, if death ends a disability or if it doesn't end a disability, the complaint in this action was timely filed. Did I answer your question, Justice? While we submit that this statute is quite old and was drafted in the middle of the 19th century, 893 contains, we can see whether 893 contains what the Court of Appeals below called peculiar wording. While we submit that its adequate syntax does not make it ambiguous, we will concede that its meaning may not immediately be clear to a modern reader. Consistent with the teaching of Landis, a clue to the meaning of 893.22 can be found in one of the very early predecessors to that statute, namely Section 9 of Chapter 103 of the Revised Statutes of 1849, contained justices at page A-3 of our appendix. That section specifies that the 6 months before, after a person dies and before the issuing of letters testamentary, and the 6 months after the issuing of letters testamentary, quote, shall not be deemed any part of the time limited by any law for the commencement of actions by executors or administrators, close quote. Thus, in our view, Section 9 provides significant insight into the 1849 legislature's intent that what would become 893.22 was indeed intended to serve as a saving statute and not as a statute of limitations. We've made other points regarding Landis in our amicus brief, and we'll rely on those without repeating them. In conclusion, we respectfully submit that 893.22 is a saving statute and that 893.16 does apply to decedents. Therefore, we respectfully submit the complaint filed on August 12, 2002 was in fact timely, and as a consequence, we respectfully ask this Court to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals in all respects. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Counsel, just before you, before you sit down, you just got a minute or so.
Sure.
On the argument of opposing counsel on the 8 and 11 years, which in this particular case, it just seems to me as a question of policy and a question of stale claims, the argument has some rings true in the sense that to expect the resurrection of these old claims 8-9 years, how could the Court address that?
Well, first of all, Justice, I think that policy questions like that are best addressed to the legislature. And much has occurred in Storm, where this Court found that, I suspect perhaps reluctantly, that 893.16 could extend the statute of limitations under 893.55, sub 1, sub A, up to 8 years. That's just the way the statutes appear to work at this point. The fact of the matter is also, Justice, as a practical matter, many of the people who might be in a position or need the benefit of the statute are probably in a pretty bad way, particularly people who are disabled with serious mental disabilities, and they might need that extra time. Did I answer your question, Justice? Thank you, Justices.
I have a question.
I'm sorry.
Is there anything in the Court of Appeals opinion you would change or would expand on or modify?
I thought it was a pretty good opinion, Chief Justice.
Okay.
But I would have probably liked to see the Court of Appeals indicate that 893.22 is a saving statute as opposed to a statute of limitations.
Would you have wanted them to decide the issue of whether disability ceases at death?
Well, see, Chief Justice, the Court of Appeals, I think, concluded that 893.22 didn't apply, and sub silencio, I think, concluded that 893.16 did not cease at the time of death. And that's how they reached the conclusion that they did.
Even though they specifically say they're not deciding that issue.
I know, Chief Justice.
But you think sub silencio they did decide?
I think they did. I don't know how else they would have reached the conclusion they did, Chief Justice.
A disability ceases at death.
I think so, Chief Justice.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Justices.
Mr. White, you're going to be a recognized lawyer in this state for about 15 minutes, and then not.
I'll try to do a good job during my limited time. May it please the Court, Madam Chief Justice, members of the Court, I'm David White. I'm an attorney from Duluth, Minnesota. I represent the plaintiff in this action, Julianne Wahlberg, who's the special administrator for the estate of her deceased mother, Lucille Genevieve Yox. This is a case that is before this Court on appeal, as you know, from an order dismissing the plaintiff's complaint, which order was reversed by the Court of Appeals below. The petitioner's interpretations of 893.16 and 893.22 will deprive the estate of Mrs. Yox and all similarly situated tort victims of the time limits allowed to them by the legislature to commence actions for injuries they have sustained. The petitioners would have you restructure the application of Chapter 893 so that every cause of action subject to every statute of limitations would be, quote, unquote, shifted to 1 year after the death of the claimant. Petitioner's counsel indicated that he has difficulty coming to an ability to cogently summarize this case. I don't have any problem with that at all. I can summarize it as follows. Lucille Yox.
Yes, no, go ahead. No.
Okay. Lucille Yox had claims for breach of contract. She had claims for tort. Those claims were dismissed by the trial court on the basis of the claim by the petitioners that Mrs. Yox, through Julianne Wahlberg, failed to meet the statute of limitations that was as a result of 893.22. And on that basis, those claims were dismissed, and those claims are no longer viable. We're here today for the purpose of reinstating Mrs. Yox's claims.
Both claims or just tort?
Both claims. Understand that the trial court dismissed both claims.
I understand that. Did your petition for review refer to both claims?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, proceed.
The question is twofold. The proper application of 893.22 is a threshold issue in this case. There are two main issues. Does 893.22 apply to this case at all? And if so, does it set a one-year deadline for all causes of action? I submit that the answer is no on both counts. The trial court adopted a statute that doesn't apply to these facts and then interpreted its action improperly. 893.22 does not apply to the facts of this case because the required elements of the statute are not present. As I indicated, this is a savings statute. It's been misconstrued by the trial court as a statute of limitations. That is, the trial court looked at it as a statute that sets a deadline rather than an extension. I submit that this is a savings statute that extends. It adds to an existing statute of limitations, but only under certain circumstances. The certain circumstances are if the deadline for the claims of a deceased person is such that it's insufficient for the representatives of that person to bring an action. The language of the statute and the application of the statute historically has said that if the person dies within 1 year of the running of the statute, that the deadline is extended to 1 year from that person's death. If the statute of limitations does not run within that 1 year, then 893.22 has no effect. I'd like you to examine the language of 893.22. It's an if-then proposition. In this instance, if a person entitled to bring an action dies before the expiration of the time limited for commencement of the action, the cause of action survives. Then an action may, and I emphasize may, be commenced by the person's representatives after the expiration of that time and within 1 year of the person's death. 893.22 is specifically limited to these conditions. I would submit that 893.22 doesn't change any underlying statute of limitations. All it does is provide, under certain circumstances, for the opening of a window after the time that the underlying statute would have expired. And the opening of that window will only occur if the death occurs within 1 year of the running of the underlying statute of limitations. Example was given briefly by Justice Robinsack about a person being in an accident. I think that the trial court has misconstrued the application of 893.22 and putting it, if you will, backwards. And I would like you to consider this example, which is the best way that I can explain it. If a person was hit by a bus 3 years ago tomorrow, and therefore that claim was subject to a 3-year statute of limitations, and that person died of a heart attack today, I submit that the proper application of 893.22 is that the statute of limitations for that claim against the bus would change from tomorrow under 893.54 to a year from today under 893.22. What the trial court and the petitioner has submitted is really just the opposite. If a person got hit by a bus today, the statute of limitations for that negligence claim would be 3 years from today. If that person then died of a heart attack tomorrow, the application of 893.22, according to the trial court and according to the petitioners, is that that statute would run 1 year from tomorrow. I submit that that's a misapplication of the statute. The conditions of 893.22 are not unclear, and I emphasize the language that the action may be commenced after the expiration of that time and within 1 year from the person's death. I think that the use of the language may be is very important, because all other statutes of limitations say shall. They don't say may be. I think that's indicative of the fact that it's entirely proper for the representatives to file their action prior to the running of the underlying statute of limitations, or after 1 year if the underlying statute of limitations is still not run. The trial court would have us believe that there is an automatic shifting, and I'm using the term that the trial court used, of every statute of limitations to 1 year from the time of the death. That's what Julie Wahlberg did. She had an underlying statute of limitations under 893.16. There had been no disagreement that Mrs. Yox was disabled. There's no disagreement that she died disabled. And 893.16 says that the cessation of the disability starts a 2-year period. These claims are brought within that period. Julie Wahlberg simply followed along with the statute of 893.16 and didn't make any attempt to comply with 893.22, because under the language of the statute and under the case law of Curran and Palmer, which recognized that unless a person dies within the last year of the statute, that 893 is inapplicable. For both claims, negligence and breach of contract claim, Mrs. Yox's death was within the limitations period and not within the last year of the limitations period. Therefore, under the Palmer and Curran decisions, 893.22 cannot be applicable. Now, I've made the statement that the trial court is asking you to determine that for every cause of action from any source, that upon the death of a claimant, that the statute of limitations is quote-unquote shifted to 1 year after their death. I don't want in any fashion mislead you or misquote the trial court, I'd like to read the portion of the trial court transcript that was the basis of the dismissal of both the tort claim and the contract claim. This court, and I'm quoting the court, this court finds that such language, referring to language specifying that death is cessation of a disability, was not included within Section 893.16 sub 1 because the intent is that upon the death of a person under disability, then the applicable statute of limitations shifts to Wisconsin Statute 893.22. And let me emphasize the next part. This interpretation is no different than in every other case where a plaintiff has a cause of action governed by an appropriate statute of limitations based on the nature of the claim and then dies, resulting in the applicable statute of limitations shifting to the one-year period set forth in Wisconsin Statute Section 893.22. That's just plain wrong. There is no basis for the trial court to have assumed that under any cause of action, any statute of limitations, that there's a shifting to 893.22. Most causes of action are subject to survival under common law or under the survival statute of 895.01. The statute of limitation remains unchanged by death.
If the death is right.
Yes.
Wouldn't it be a lot simpler if there were simply a one-year limitation after a death? Wouldn't everybody know what the rule was then?
If that were the case, and you can say, well, that might not be a bad idea, and possibly it isn't a bad idea, but what we're proposing here, what the petitioner is proposing, is a wholesale revamping of all the statutes of limitation under 893.20, under Chapter 893.22. It's in effect adding a phrase on the end of each statute of limitation that says, or 1 year after the death of the claimant. And it may be a good idea. It may be simpler. Maybe everybody would understand it. But that isn't the law. And if the legislature wants to adopt that, they can do it. Under 893.22, the savings statute, which has historically been in effect for 120-some years, the purpose of 893.22 is to provide a reasonable period which has been determined by the drafters of 893.22 to be a minimum of 1 year after the death of a claimant for their survivors to organize their activities and decide whether or not to bring a claim and then bring that claim. And I don't think the issue is whether it would be better if it was 1 year. The question is whether it is 1 year. And under 893.22, there is no applicability because the circumstances of this case just do not meet the preconditions for the application of 893.22.
Well, if I might suggest,
yes.
Mr. Knutson is not suggesting that in the event of death, all causes of action that survive have to be brought within 1 year. He is just saying that when there's a disability, it has to be brought within 1 year. But other causes of action that still have time running will be brought later than 1 year. And that's what the words expiration of that time means in 893.21. So the simplification about death is only for disability, not for everybody. So you still have to figure out whether they were under disability or something else. You would agree? I mean, that's what the position of
Mr. I don't agree with what Mr. Knutson's position is, because Mr. Knutson's position, changes frequently. And the position that was presented to this court this morning is different than what the trial court ruled. It's different than what positions have been. The effect of the trial court ruling has been to adopt a one-year statute for all causes of action and the dismissal upon death. And Mrs. Yox's claims have been dismissed on that basis. Is this an extreme result to have 1 year for all causes of action? That's what's happened to Mrs. Yox. In the case of Mrs. Yox, we had statutory language under 893.16. which is clear on its face. That language was followed. We have statutory language under 893.22, which, according to the trial court, is clear on its face. I submit that the language of 893.22 was improperly assessed by the trial court, improperly applied, and that the claims of Mrs. Yocks were improperly dismissed under the language of 893.22. Madam Chief Justice, you asked the question earlier of Mr. Gleisner whether he wished that the Court of Appeals had done something differently. I will say that I wish that they had ruled on the issue of whether death constitutes cessation of disability. I submitted in my brief to the Court of Appeals case law from other states, the quotation and submission from CJS about the general rule, which indicated that in all cited instances, death constitutes cessation of a disability in this type of statute and this type of statutory actions in other states. I have to presume that there is no authority for the argument that death doesn't constitute cessation. I've been unable to find it. Petitioner has submitted none. I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. White, for your presentation as a Pohatuchee counsel.
Mr. Knutson, referring to the hypothetical posed by Mr. White, let's say I was hit by a bus today, and how long do my heirs have to file suit?
Under the wrongful death statute, they have 3 years. You know, what they didn't say is certainly arguments change because they look at the entirety of what's before you. The wrongful death statute says 3 years. I think when looking at the case law and the argument, that what 893.22 should be interpreted to say is it's the original statute of limitations for the underlying action and one more year for everybody. No matter what, who you are, what estate, or what the heirs are, you get 1 year. I think that 893.16 only applies for the person while they're alive, and I think that makes sense.
Well, let's suppose I fell today and broke my arm because of the negligence of some premises, and then later today I had a heart attack and died. How much time?
3 years.
Because?
Because I think that's the statute of limitations on the underlying tort.
What, plus one?
No, you'd only have the plus one if you were in the third year. That's how you read that. I think what it says is, it's 3 years, the underlying time, and frankly, I think Justice Breyer pointed out the problem in the language. It probably should say, or 1 year from the date of death.
It says, after the expiration of that time, referring to all the other statute of limitations, and 1 year. And it doesn't say whichever is later.
Except that the court's cases that have been referred to already have interpreted that to be the underlying statute plus 1 year. I submit, Judge Justice Posner, that if something happened to you, your family would have 3 years. If you had the heart attack 2.5 years from now, they would have 1 year from the date of your heart attack is the way to read that logically. What the plaintiffs want you to do, or the respondents here today, is if during the time that you had that accident, it was disclosed that you were mentally ill, under the Court of Appeals decision, your heirs would have 8 years to bring that statute. It'd be different for anybody else under that situation because the Court of Appeals just simply ignores the issue of whether 893.22 applies at all. It is a dilemma. And frankly, it's why, as I read the facts, as you reassess them in your statement, it makes sense to me when reading the entirety of the cases and reading the statutes that what should apply is when you die. 893.22 gives you a year from the date of death if the underlying statute hasn't run, or the underlying statute, whichever is more. And I think that your prior case decisions support that change. Certainly the trial court did the shifting and simply said, when you die, you get 1 year. I think that's correct. And If you look at the actual argument at the trial court, I did something that Chief Justice Abrahamson told my son 5 years ago. He was here and there was an objection made, and the Chief Justice recommended to him how he deal with that. And he argued with her. And she pointed out that may not be very smart. At the trial court level, as I listened to the judge's decision, I realized that what I was arguing didn't harmonize the statutes, and I did react and listen to that. As I read these cases and look at the entirety of the problem before you, I think the logical and appropriate finding for you is to find, you get 1 year from the date of death or the underlying statute, but certainly 893.16 should not give the estate or the heirs of someone who may be disabled in the last months of their life 8 full years to bring a tort action. I don't think that was what's said. I don't think it makes sense. And I don't think that that is the law.
If I understand your argument, and maybe I didn't in your first argument, I had written it down that if a person dies, then the estate gets one more year than the usual statute of limitations. So that's not right.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's the usual tort statute of limitation. They get 3 years, or if they die essentially in that last year, they would get an additional year from the date of their death. And that's, I think, what the case is.
If they don't die in the last year, you say they only have, what do they have?
3 years. In other words, if they die 2 months later, I think the original tort action would be 3 years, and I think that's consistent with the wrongful death action.
So if Justice Prosser breaks his arm today, which we hope will not happen, because we're not going to let him out of the courthouse, then unfortunately dies in an unrelated incident of a heart attack, his estate has how long to bring a tort action on the arm?
I think it makes sense to give 3 years.
About 3 years?
If he dies 2.5 years from now, I would give him an additional 1 year.
Not 1 year and 6 months, but just 1 year.
1 year, because it's the last year.
And if he dies within 2 years, you're going to give him 1 year?
Yeah. If he dies in 2.5 years, you get 2.5 years, or 3.5 years.
Okay. Got it.
However, if you take the other argument the other way, if we were all to conclude for some reason that Justice Prosser was mentally ill today, the Court of Appeals would give him 8 years. That's the problem, is that it treats it so differently. Okay. And it's the heirs that are treated differently.
He's mentally ill, and he has 3 years if he's not mentally ill. When he dies, again, the same fact situation, breaks his arm, dies of a heart attack, all today. And he's mentally ill, too. What does he get?
The Court of Appeals decision, his heirs get 8 years. If he will.
I don't know what your reading of the statute is.
Under my reading of the statute, if he dies, he would get 1 year from the date of death.
So he gets less because he's mentally ill than a non-mentally ill person gets. Because under the non-mentally ill person, you give him 3 years.
And I believe.
I mean, it's not you. That's your reading of the statute.
No, my reading of the statute is that during his life, he would have up to 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
But that upon his death, that 893.22 would apply, and it'd be 1 year unless he still had time under the original three.
Well, he does. He had 3 years under the example that we're working under.
Then I don't think, in fact, that 893.16 would apply to him at all.
So you just give him 3 years.
Right.
Mentally ill, breaks his arm,
and dies within a few months.
Dies of a heart attack. Same day, you give him 3 years.
That's correct. Because if we look at who we're trying to protect, we were trying to protect a mentally ill person, not his heirs or estate.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Knutson, and thank you, Mr. Gleisner and Mr. White, for your arguments on yet another case to come to the court on interpretation of statute of limitations and tolling. of statute of limitations. That concludes our argument in 03-2164, Julia Ann Wahlberg v. St. Francis Home, Inc. et al. The court will be in recess till 1:30. The students and anyone else who wishes may remain to discuss with the justice of the procedures of the court. We are in recess.